Now we come to the question that was asked about the Communist Party, the Stalinists. It is at this juncture that the Stalinists make their first major attack on the strike leadership. They used for that device a man by the name of William F. Dunn, the elder of the Dunn brothers, blood brother to Vincent, Grant, and Raymond, who were three of the foremost leaders in the strike, but who, unlike them, had stayed in the Communist Party and supported Stalin in the split that took place in 1928, whereas Ray and Miles and Grant had gone with the Trotskyist cadre. They come out with a pamphlet entitled Counter-Revolution in Minneapolis. And what was one of the central points? That it shows you what kind of renegades and reformists and traitors of the working class we are, that we hadn't gone right on and seized power and extended power as of the culmination of the Battle of Deputy Run. And there were all kinds of additions, but that was the essence of it, and gives you the central feel of the situation. At that time, the Communist Party was in its third period, as it was called, when the whole norm of their procedure was to try to substitute the vanguard for the mass in simulated class actions and advance the most extreme demands in those struggles. Where they had taken the militants of the Communist Party out of the established unions and tried to build what they called a red trade union international. And where all they had succeeded in doing was in isolating the militants of the Communist Party from the masses and pursuing a policy that made it impossible for them to make fusion with the spontaneous masses at that point in struggle in any way, shape, or form. Now, they had no influence in the truck drivers' union. As a matter of fact, the leadership of the union had to protect them from the strikers. There was a kind of a mixed reaction on the part of the Trotskyists, because this is now 6 years after the split in 1928. And following the split in 1928, down through those years, the Communist Party had been sending goon squads to break up Trotskyist meetings. They had barged into meetings like this, rushed in and beat up people in the hall. And the upshot of it was that the Communist Party was unable to have any influence on the strike, unable in any way to turn the membership against the strike leadership, just the opposite. Now, in fact, we had a new kind of problem for us. Olson's double cross had forced us into what was to become yet another general truck driver strike, and as you'll see, an even rougher one than that I have just described to you. This strike that's coming now posed some new strategic and tactical problems for the leadership. It was necessary to assume from the outset the probability of new and more vicious forms of police violence, namely gunfire, in the next strike. It was necessary to expect in advance new forms of treachery against the Union through the maneuvers of Olson with the backing of the Union bureaucrats. It was necessary to find a way to keep the drivers solidarized with the inside workers within 574 and to mobilize general labor support for renewal of the struggle. And it was necessary also to get this new stage of conflict on the road, to begin now some consolidations of the changed structural form of Local 574 that had been taking place during the strike. And take the latter point first. An ever tighter organizational liaison between the membership and the leadership was forged now, based on mutual understanding, confidence, and trust between membership and leadership as it had been forged in battle in the May strike. A democratic internal strike structure was now developed that became a very potent instrument in the next stage of the battle that is before us. The small organizing committee that was selected democratically as a sort of an executive committee of the larger volunteer organizing committee that had done the mobilizing of the workers generally before the May strike became constituted as what was in actuality the central leadership of the strike. The organizing committee, as the central leadership in turn, functioned in close liaison with a strike committee of 100. The strike committee of 100 was not just a happen chance body of 100 people. It was democratically selected, adjusted, staffed, restaffed by the strikers themselves in the course of the struggle. It began with a selection of 100 among those who had proven themselves the best in the May strike. And as the battle went on, it was adjusted some again by the strikers. That strike committee of 100 was genuinely representative of the ranks of the strikers as a whole. In a broad sense, this organizational internal structure of the democratic function within the ranks of this striking union was analogous to our concept in the Socialist Workers' Party of the selection of our central leading body, the National Committee. Nobody can get on the National Committee of the Socialist Workers' Party without getting the votes in the ranks. Nobody can butter up a leader and get pushed into the National Committee. They have to get the votes in the ranks. And there's only one way you can get the votes in the ranks, and that is to conduct yourself in such a way that the members conclude you'd make a good leader. And in that sense, this strike committee of 100, forged in the heat of the battle, was somewhat analogous to the more deliberate, conscious way in which the Socialist Workers' Party selects its central leading body. Now, secondly, within this strike committee of 100, a strong cadre of secondary leaders emerged in the test of fire in the battles that were to come. And as you'll see at one juncture when we were getting one of Olson's double crosses, they played a crucial role in saving the strike. They proved their worth time and again, and it was precisely from among these secondary leaders that developed out of the strike committee of 100 during the heat of battle that some of the staunchest and most solid members of the Socialist Workers' Party came that were recruited in the heat of those struggles. In addition to that, frequent membership meetings were held. Whether or not the union was on strike or off. And at the membership meetings, there was always full and free discussion None of this business of the membership gathering and the chairman doing most of the talking, some official, some bureaucrat from the platform having to say so, and the workers sitting there and listening. There was full and free discussion. Moreover, during the strikes, the ranks were kept up to date by daily reports over a loudspeaker system installed in the strike headquarters. Generally, in the evening after the day's work was over, it became a tendency that the workers would stay around for a while after the evening meal in the strike commissary, and one and another, not always the leader, sometimes a marshal of some particular picket detachment, or maybe again the head of the commissary committee would be giving up. They were giving them hell because they weren't bringing their dishes back to the sink after they got through eating. But in one way and another, every night, over the loudspeaker, anybody who wanted to stay around would be brought right up to the minute. Comments would be made about what the newspapers had said in their columns and their editorials that day. Some statement some labor faker had made would be answered by one of the leaders, or something Olson had been popping off about would be analyzed, and the workers would be clarified about it. Then, in the second strike, we developed one of the most crucial instruments of all. A daily strike paper was called the Organizer. And this became vital in this second battle. And the workers appreciated it, they learned from it, and they were proud of it. Were they proud that their union comes out with a paper and we got guys on our side that can write just as good and even write better, and unlike than those guys on the daily papers, and unlike them, they write the truth. And the workers, as I mentioned before, mainly the women carried the load, but the strikers and their supporters as a whole were enthusiastic backers of the paper. And we raised enough money to keep a daily one-page tabloid going throughout the whole six-odd week period of the second strike, and even a little money to buy a few things for the commissary and one thing another. By the device of the strikers, their wives, their supporters, going out with a bundle of the Daily Organizer and a can. We didn't charge anything for the paper, but every time you give somebody a paper, you hold a can. And you'd be surprised how many times somebody would shove a $5 bill, even in 1934, when a $5 bill was a lot more money, relatively, than it is today. And you would find people driving in the evening from all parts of town down by the strike headquarters for the express purpose of picking up a copy of the Organizer. And we developed quite a substantial circulation and became a very vital instrument for the union in the whole strike, and was far from the least of the vanguard contributions that was made in that battle of the instrumentalities that make it possible to carry forward a battle in the way it ought to be carried forward. Also, the whole party was mobilized in support of the party fraction leading the action in Minneapolis. Comrade Cannon, the national secretary of the party, came to Minneapolis and stayed right there and performed his central leadership function in the party by acting first and foremost right at the scene of action to do everything possible to mobilize the support of the party as a whole. Highly skilled writers, one or two of whom today have got very good jobs in the editorial stable of one or another of the big weekly magazines, wrote on the Daily Organizer in 1934. The party sent unemployed organizers who'd had experience in Pennsylvania and Ohio and California and Michigan and in other areas in to help us with the organization, the tightening of the liaison for the mobilization of the unemployed in support of the second strike. In short, it was an all-sighted demonstration of a combat party in action. A democratically centralized party acting as a compact unit, as a single force with a single purpose, with a single policy, and that within the framework of a combat formation, the truck drivers and inside workers of Minneapolis, who are organized in a democratic internal union structure along lines akin to democratic centralism, where in every respect there was democracy in deciding, but there was discipline in action. The leadership had unquestioned authority during combat. When we were clashing with the cops, or as later with the National Guard, any time a leader of the strike gave an order, it had to be carried out. There was no two ways about it. And if somebody in the ranks objected to carrying out, the leaders didn't have to discipline him. The rest of the ranks did. But the other side of it was that in these regular reports and in these frequent membership meetings where there was full and democratic discussion that I mentioned to you, the policies of the leadership in the battles were subject to review and criticism by the membership. And in this, you had a limited preview of future actions to be led by our vanguard party in the great class struggles that are to come. And when you think of it in these terms, you begin to get a real concrete understanding of what we mean when we say we're out to organize a loyal, disciplined, Leninist-type combat party that functions on the democratic working class principles of democratic centralism. Here you have an image of what it's all about as it occurred at this brief but significantly important moment in the history of class struggle in the United States and in the history of the intervention of the Socialist Workers' Party in class struggle. Now, as I said, another problem we had was to mobilize general labor support for this new showdown with the bosses. We began here by pointing toward the organization of a mass parade all the way through the heart of the town, culminating in a mass rally at the municipal auditorium. And we got a tremendous response, not only from the truck drivers and inside workers of 574, but from the rank and file of other unions and from unorganized employed workers and from unemployed workers. And here again, as we had done with Olson, we used some of the city politicians. There was one alderman. He had the kind of a voice, he didn't need a loudspeaker. He anticipated electronics. That man could call a hog in Arkansas from the northwest corner of Nebraska. He was a vain, a pompous, a self-seeking, big voice, pea-sized minded man. And we found his contradiction, and we put him on record for the second strike by the device of making him marshal of the parade and giving him a white horse to ride. And he did. He did. He did. As they say in Missouri, where I come from, there's more than one way to nub ducks, you know. And in this way, we involved, again, the union bureaucrats and the reformist politicians while we were mobilizing the ranks. And some speeches were made at the auditorium that were somewhat akin to the speeches I described to you last night that were made at the settlement of the coal strike. They're sure Olson will get this thing straightened out. We must understand Olson, and we're not going to have to strike, and so on. But Bill Brown was the last speaker, and Bill was a natural-born orator. I contend generally that before anybody can speak at all, you got to think a little about it, you got to study it a little, you got to practice it a little, but every once in a while somebody comes along, it's a natural, and Bill was one. I've seen him sit down just 5 minutes before a meeting, take an envelope and put about 6 words on the back of the envelope and get up and make a stimulating speech. And that's exactly what he did at this meeting. We got about 25,000 people in this huge municipal auditorium. Brown's the last speaker, and he winds up his speech with the statement, "The only good boss is a dead boss." Next morning, the papers are out. Oh, boy, long editorials, and the theme is Brown's Formula. And they really went to town. Well, it was an extremist statement, you know. But what is it that we've heard lately, you know, about extremism in defense of liberty? But anyway, we had them involved. Now we're at the eve of strike. And another breed of domestic political animal capitalist variety steps in, namely the federal mediator. A fellow by the name of Dunnigan, mediator assigned by the Department of Labor in Washington. I always remembered him. He wore pince-nez glasses with a black ribbon and had a row of cigars in the pocket where I got these glasses. Come to the strike headquarters, we're getting ready for the next battle. Comes in, introduces himself. Typical line of the mediator. This is a law with mediators in class struggle. Their role is to come in and pretend they're the friend of the workers, get the workers to give them confidence, give them authority, and then go sell you out. Their function is not to attain justice in any way, shape, or form for a working man or woman. Their justice is to prevent a strike from taking place if they can. And if one starts to get it stopped just as quick as they can, with as little as possible for the workers, but above all, get it stopped. Dunnigan comes in. Well, he just got to town. Apparently, he didn't read much. And he thought he was talking to a run-of-the-mind group of workers that just come from nowhere, as was happening all over the country then, just organizing and wondering, we're organized, what are we going to do, how we go about it, and looking for somebody to give him some advice. He tells us, I understand your problem. Now, you give me the authority, and I'm going to go over, and I'll talk to the governor. I'll get the governor to cooperate with me, and I'll go talk to the bosses. And you give me a little latitude here, and I'll bring you back a settlement. We said, well, Mr. Dunnigan, we appreciate your generous gesture, your magnificent demonstration of recognition that there's some justice on our side, but I'll tell you what you do. That's what we told you. You go over, and you see the bosses. You come back and tell us what the boss has said, and then we'll tell you whether we like it or not. Well, we got into the strike and came to a new climactic point, and a second mediator came in, a man by the name of Father Haas, who was part of a special federal mediation service that had been set up, and he and Dunnigan worked as a team. Now, I'm getting ahead a little, but I want to talk about mediators for a moment. At one juncture, our negotiating committee is meeting with Haas and Dunnigan. Still no direct meetings with the bosses. And they've given us what they consider a settlement. And they demand that we recommend it to the ranks. Our negotiating committee said, no, we won't. Oh, just let me point out, this is a very important thing about negotiating. Talking about tactics. It's fatal to send your negotiators into a negotiation with power to settle, because they're behind the eight ball. They're subject to get shoved off in the room, and all the pressure in the world is put on them. And you put your negotiators and the organization itself in jeopardy. The strongest position for a negotiator is never have authority to say yes or no. They'll take it back. It serves the dual function of keeping you in the best possible strategic position in negotiating and minimizing the dangers of somebody weakening and selling you out when they go in there as your negotiator. Haas and Dunnigan tried to do this to our negotiating team, and when it was refused, they demanded the right to go before the Committee of 100 with their proposition. And they were allowed to go before the Committee of 100. And as they were leaving the hall after the meeting, and the workers had told them out in no uncertain terms, you would have witnessed the spectacle of a young Irish Catholic truck driver reach down inside his shirt, rip the crucifix off his neck, and hurl it into the face of the priest mediator as he walked out of the meeting. Class struggle is very educational in many ways. Now, in the second walkout, we very quickly came to the most brutal phase of all the fighting, what is known as Bloody Friday. The police laid a trap, this time in the wholesale grocery district. The police had been equipped with riot guns. It's a shotgun type of weapon that carries a number 4 slug. And it's just one small stage short of a dum-dum bullet. It's a vicious thing. It's a vicious thing. They laid a trap, and they opened fire on the unarmed pickets. They shot down over 50 pickets in a matter of 10 minutes. Most of them shot in the back, trying to escape from the guns, 2 of them killed. The immediate reaction of the workers was to go home and get their revolvers, their shotguns, their deer rifles, souvenir bayonets from World War I, trench knives, anything they could lay hands on for a weapon, and come back to the strike headquarters with it. Seething with anger, intimidated, terrorized, no. And here you have the positive side of the democratic illusion in workers. The negative side of it is that until the lessons of class struggle life teaches them otherwise, workers think they really got some democratic rights in this capitalist society and class analysis. The positive side is when they find out it's not so, as these workers were finding out, then the positive side comes forward in the sense that they fight for what they truly thought were their rights that they feel are being taken away, and they look at the cop as the violator of the law of the land, not themselves, and they propose to take the law in their own hands. That first and fundamental law that's basic to all nature, the law of self-defense. The duty of the strike leadership was a disarmament. It wasn't a pleasant task. But you'll find the more you attain responsibility as a leader, that there's a lot about being a leader that is not pleasant. Anybody that wants to have a lark, to have a good thing with all kinds of honors, not too much responsibility, and feel that you're free from problems because you can decide, don't ever set out to be a leader, because that's not the way it is. That's not the way it is. A leader has got to be conscious, and a leader has got to know why and how sometimes to do things that at that moment of rage the workers can't understand. And believe you me, it's not easy. But if the leadership had just stood supinely and let the workers go out on the streets and take after those cops, in those circumstances the kind of a bloodbath would have developed that would have been inherent in the situation, we'd have had the whole federal army in Minneapolis in no time at all. You couldn't win. You couldn't win. So the duty of the leadership was to disarm those strikers, send them out without arms. Now, what saved the situation was a combination of the anger, the determination of the workers, and the new waves of support. The bosses thought they were terrorizing. If anything, we got more support. Around town, the minute the city learned about Bloody Friday, than we'd had before. The anger, the determination that came out of that, the fact we had these flying squadrons by this time so skillfully organized and tooled and manned and led, and the fact the cops didn't know the leadership had disarmed the strikers. Those were the things that saved the situation. The cops began to escort one truck at a time. You had the spectacle. They would take a truck, anything, whatever, and there would be a convoy of about 40 prowl cars. 4 cops to a car, 4 riot guns sticking out the windows of the prowl car like machine guns out of a tank, 20 of them in front of the truck, 20 behind, and they would always go right through the heart of the downtown sector for the demonstration. And you would find 80 picket cars flanking the 40 carloads of cops. So you'd have three abreast, the cops in the middle, two lines of picket cars. We wouldn't try to stop it, but we just added to the parade. And the cops didn't know whether or not there were guns in those picket cars, and, you know, they really didn't want to find out. Well, the cops do this a couple of times, and then they would begin to reduce the number of squad cars to a truck. And the minute they reduced the number of squad cars, we'd redouble the number of picket cars, and this would convince them that we're going to begin stopping them now. And they'd shift back. And it just became tug and saw here, and it became impossible for them. Olson had to intervene. So he cooked up a scheme with Haas and Dunnigan. They came up with what they called the Haas-Dunnigan plan. It was a lousy thing, but it did have union recognition. It did grant a certain recognition of the right to an increase in pay. It did recognize drivers and inside workers. It did have the seniority clause. Did have certain regulations on hours and overtime. It did have a guarantee that all strikers will be returned their job without discrimination. And Olson announced that the Haas-Dunnigan plan is going to be presented to the union and to the bosses. And if it is rejected by either side, he is going to declare martial law and enforce the Haas-Dunnigan plan as the terms of settlement of the strike. Now, it was laid for us, naturally. But here again, we managed to outthink them. A deadline was set of noon on a certain day. I think it was a Saturday. It was a very hot day, I remember. We met in a big hall over on the east side in Minneapolis. Why I remember it was hot was because we wanted to make sure, the deadline was noon, and we wanted to make sure that the bosses didn't get any word until the deadline as to the union action. As we figured, the bosses would count on us rejecting the settlement, and then they would accept it, and Olson would turn the guard loose on us. We closed all the windows. We had thousands of men in this huge auditorium. We closed all the windows. And we had ourselves a meeting. All the workers were sore about it. It was an unfair, rotten settlement. But we thrashed it out there. We debated it from every point of view, and we came out with a unanimous vote that the workers understood of the tactical necessity of the union accepting the Haas-Dunnigan plan. We told them, we don't think the bosses are going to accept it. We don't think it's going to end the strike, but you have to assume that possibility, but this is why we got to do it. And we'd made the decision a couple of hours before the deadline, and with everybody's agreement, everybody just sweltering and suffering, we sat there just a few minutes before the deadline. Bill Brown went to the telephone, called the governor, and said, the union accepts the Haas-Dunnigan plan. The bosses hadn't said a word. A couple hours later, they announced they accepted with reservations, which was that they didn't accept it at all. And with this, Olson declared martial law and installed the National Guard headquarters in the armory in downtown Minneapolis, threw the troops out on the streets. Pretty soon you had these farm boys, their bayonets walking back and forth under the awnings of the stores downtown and getting the bayonet caught in the awning and damn near cutting their throat. But he announces that out at the any employer comes out to the National Guard headquarters and signs the Haas-Dunnigan plan can operate. So all the small fry bosses, little one-horse outfits that never intended to live up to anything, they sign anyway, they all rush down and sign. Pretty soon all the trucks of these little operators are out with a big poster on the front of the windshield, operating by permission of the military authorities under the Haas-Dunnigan plan. And we go this way for a while, and big bosses begin to put the heat on. They take Olson to court and try to get an injunction against martial law, and then they start claiming that this is interfering with interstate commerce. We're depriving sick people in hospitals. All the pressures in the world are put on, and little by little, Olson begins to let other trucks operate under military control. In short, he's beginning to break the strike on a piecemeal basis. So we held a protest rally of the Union at a big public playground known as the Parade Grounds, where we denounced this whole thing and announced to one and all that the Union is going out the next day, and whether or not there's any tin hats along, if a truck is on the streets that the owner hasn't signed up and under the Haas-Dunnigan plan, we're going to stop it. Well, about 4 o'clock the next morning, some of us are in the headquarters, and suddenly we hear, as the poets say, the measured tread of booted feet. The National Guard is marching up the street from the army and surrounding the strike headquarters. They surround the whole block and they train machine guns on the front doors of the headquarters that the picket cars came in and out of. And the colonel in command of the guard, a judge from Duluth, Minnesota, comes in and announces he's taking possession. And he's got a list of the names of the leaders of the strike. And don't think the bosses didn't know who the leaders were. He didn't have any of the formal executive board. He had the real leadership of the strike on his list. They got some of the leaders. The first one they got was Ray Dunn. One or two of us managed to get through the police lines or the military lines by a ruse. And they had set up a military stockade at the state fairground out in the edge of town. They threw all the leaders they could grab in there, and they began arresting pickets and throwing them in there. And in the headquarters were still all these guns and bayonets and butcher knives we'd taken away from the pickets on Bloody Friday. And so the military, they sort all these out, and they've got them laid out on a table, all tagged. Newspapers come in, take pictures of them. The evening papers have got huge pictures and all this arsenal that is found in the strike headquarters. But meantime, Olson has sent word through the Union bureaucrats that he wants to meet a rank and file committee of the Union, and here's where the secondary leaders come into the picture. Secondary leaders that have been developing in the strike committee of 100. Olson meets them in the offices of the Labor Review, the official paper of the Central Labor Union, in case you don't think there was some conniving going on between Olson and the bureaucrats. They come in. Olson, he was an old dock walloper. When he was with workers, he liked to play the worker angle. He chewed Yankee Girl tobacco. And he, workers there, he liked to put his feet upon a table and get a gobloon over and take a chew tobacco and spit, you know, and talk workers' language. And so he pulls this tobacco out of his pocket and start passing around this rank and file committee. It happened to be Kelly Postal, Ray Rainbolt, and Jack Maloney. A couple of three pretty tough cookies as they go. He passes the pack around, they take it. By the time he gets back to the governor, there's no Yankee Girl. So he has to sit there and look at his spittoon while the rank and file committee chooses tobacco. All he gives them a song and dance, and they tell him, "All right, we want to be reasonable. Now, just a couple of things we want you to do, Governor." "Well, anything within reason. What is it you want?" "Well," they say, "one, let our leaders out of your stockade. Two, give us back our strike headquarters. Three, take your troops off the streets. Then we'll be willing to talk contract." Meantime, those of us in the central leadership that the military hadn't managed to grab, together with the others on the strike committee of 100, have organized auxiliary headquarters all over town, generally using friendly filling stations. And a little mayhem is being committed, not only on the trucks on the street, but on some soldiers, too. It was quite an afternoon. The casualty lists in the paper the next morning made somewhat instructive and interesting reading for statisticians that like to study things like that from that point of view. Between what's happening to his tin hats and the scab trucks that he's let loose under military protection and the hard time he's having with the rank and file committee and the editorial office's Labor Review, Olson decided he had to back off. So He admitted finally that it was a mistake. They had claimed that we hadn't had a permit for our public rally the night before, which we had had, by the way. He knew it. But now he says a mistake, and he orders the military to restore the headquarters. Amusing thing, one of the secondary leaders of the strike goes up, and he thought justice is justice, and among other things, he made the commander of the military detachment that was holding down the headquarters account on his own inventoried list for every revolver, rifle, shotgun, trench knife, and what have you that they had seized the day they raided the headquarters. We got the headquarters back, and it developed into a sitz creek. Olson had to back off. The police hadn't been able to break the strike. They hadn't been able to break the strike with the military. They hadn't been able to outflank the leadership of the strike and defeat the strike by tricking the membership. See the value of a tightly knit, democratically organized, consciously functioning machine when you're in a battle? What were they going to do? It developed into a sitz creek. It settled down, in fact, to a war of nerves, to a process of attrition. We were pretty worn down by then, I can tell you. This battle had been going on quite a while. But here's another important thing to keep in mind. In these kind of clutches, and you're in a fight, you know, and you're beginning to feel awful tired, always remember the other guy is not necessarily as fresh as a daisy anymore. And if you can hang on just a little bit longer by the skin of your teeth, sometimes you'll win. You know this theme novelists are so fond of using about how one guy is slicker than another and he's just pounding the devil out of him in a fist fight because of his superior skill, but the other guy is more rugged and he's taking it. He can seldom get a blow in, and all of a sudden he found he's won because the other guy just falls from exhaustion. He can't throw another punch. these factors operate in struggles of this kind. And just when we were on the ropes and actually beginning to talk about the problem of how to call off the strike and at least get some of the best militants back on the job if we could, the bosses folded. It took the form of a special mediator coming in as a face-saving device and a formula that was a sort of a combination of the Haas-Dunnigan plan and the utilization of the collective bargaining election through the National Labor Relations Board that had appeared in the case of the coal strike was put together, and on that basis the bosses agreed to a settlement that, while it wasn't what the workers deserved, as it was looked over in a cold, hard, and calculated way, we had to recognize it was much as we could get at the time. It established, it legalized the union and the industry, and it gave us the point of departure to go ahead now with the union building job. And on that basis, we settled the strike. At a membership meeting where the terms of settlement were read and freely discussed. And another thing to remember about strikes, about all actions, while some people are too quick to quit, and there's that key problem I just mentioned of trying to hang on a little longer because maybe the opposition is worse off than you are, there are always some that don't know when to quit. And when the terms of settlement are read and recommended by the leadership and the situation explained, one of the drivers gets up and says, "What's happened to the leaders of this union? Have you lost your guts?" With that note, in our next session, and I won't speak as long as I have tonight, I'll go into how we consolidated a union and made a magnificent fighting instrument out of it with that kind of workers and that kind of a situation.